Good morning. My name is Tim Porter. I'm one of the pastors here for Faith Community. Thank you for taking the time to be here with us this morning on this balmy January morning. If you're here at the beginning of the service, you heard our host Tim Prince talk about how during this time we take some time, we invest some time in our gathering together to learn from the scriptures together. And I just want to invite you as well that if there's anything I say that is confusing, or if you have questions about anything I'm talking about here from the scriptures, or if you are wondering, you know, how do I start following after Jesus? I'll be available right after the service and would love to answer any questions you might have, okay? So that's afterward, and come on up, and I'd love to chat. I suffer from a horrible condition called trying to do way too much in a short amount of time. And I suffer from a competing condition. I've already victimized myself, haven't I? But I suffer from a competing condition, and that is that I do not fully estimate well how long it takes to travel from point A to point B. I tend to think that I can get places much more quickly than I actually can. And that has resulted in, often, as in last Friday, breaking a promise. I established a routine and I established a promise with our oldest son, Levi, at the beginning of the fall that we would get together on Friday mornings and do some schoolwork together starting at 9:15 in the morning. Pastor Tim Prince is joining us on Friday morning to learn biblical Greek together, and we set that time up, 9:15. Well, the last couple weeks I've been trying to stuff a lot of things in the morning before I get back to the house to do that class with them, and I broke a promise with our oldest son that I would be there and we would start on time. And he was annoyed. He was frustrated, and even though it's just, you know, it's just time, right? I was about 25 minutes late or so, I think, something like that, when he texted and said, "Where are you?" And, I felt bad, and it's not a big promise to break, you know, but you know what it's like to be held up at an appointment, and that sets back the whole day if you've stacked your day up to move from one thing to another, and he's under all kinds of pressure with school right now, and it was not good. It wasn't helpful. It wasn't right. It wasn't just. Now, we're in a series called Every Human Heart, and what we're doing is we're looking and saying, look at the scriptures to see how God has made us, and he has made us with a heart, and not your physical heart, though we all have those, but the heart is the causal center of the human being. It's the reason why you do what you do, the reason why I do what I do. I have certain desires in my heart for certain things, and you have certain desires in your heart for certain things that we all hold in common. And that's the reason why we do what we do. And when we're looking at these desires and how the Bible talks about these desires, because these desires can easily get twisted and reshaped and reworked. And so we started this series looking at every human heart has a desire for purpose. Last week we talked about how every human heart has a desire for victory. We'll look at every human heart has a desire for security and belonging and love, significance, approval. But today we're going to talk about how every human heart desires justice. Why is it that Levi was disappointed? Why is it that Levi was frustrated? Why was he annoyed and somewhat angry? Rightfully so. Because he desires justice. He desires to be treated justly. And so do you. Now, there's a little difference in this talk, in this sermon, in the whole series, because instead of sort of tapping into what we all sort of feel, I'm going to ask you to get in somebody else's shoes. Because this sermon is not so much about how you and I want justice and how that leads us into arguments and all kinds of things. But this sermon, because of the text we're looking at today, is about how every human being that you encounter is deserving of you treating them justly. It's a requirement. It's a due. It's an obligation. And so I'm going to ask you to look through life through somebody else's shoes and what they require from you. We're going to be looking at a passage today in Micah 6, a famous justice passage. Micah 6, We're going to look at just verses 3 through 8, and we're looking at pages 779 and 780, 779 to 780, and the Bible's in front of you. If you'd like to read along with one of the copies in the front of you, it'll be on the screens as well. What we're looking at here today is that God requires us to give justice, to do justice to others, and it's a response. It's a response to a relationship with Him. It's a response to a relationship with Him. That's what we're looking at today. As you're turning, just a little context for this passage. This is an ancient text. It was written in the 8th century B.C., in 8th century, and it was written to the people of Israel by this prophet named Micah, and Micah's job was to, as a prophet, was to enforce the covenant relationship that God was in with his people. He made promises to them, and they made promises to him, and the people had become corrupt. And God was calling them into a courtroom situation. That's the scene that we have in front of us, a courtroom situation where God is presiding over the trial, and Micah is the prosecuting attorney, as it were. And so he's asking questions on the Lord's behalf. He calls the witnesses of the mountains. The mountains are witnesses to this covenant that was established and how Israel is guilty of not being just. And not being the way that God showed them to be. That's the context. Here's some of the verses that go into this. Beginning in verse 3, this is how the Lord asks, or Micah asks on behalf of the Lord. O my people, what have I done to you? How have I wearied you? Answer me. For I brought you up from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery. And I sent before you Moses and Aaron and Miriam. Oh, my people, remember what Balak, king of Moab, devised and what Balaam, the son of Beor, answered him and what happened from Shittim to Gilgal, that you may know the righteous acts of the Lord. And the people on trial respond, well, with what shall I come before the Lord? And bow myself before God on high. Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams and 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? And the Lord responds, he has told you, oh man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? But to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Now, I just want to begin a little bit by talking about where history is going and where God is leading us. The Bible ends with this grand declaration that a new heavens and new earth have been created, and in this new heavens and new earth, there is no more mourning, there is no more sickness, there is no more pain, there is no more crying, there is no more mourning, and the former things have passed away. And part of that group of the former things that have passed away is injustice. That's why there is no more mourning. That's why there is no more sin going on. Injustice has passed away. And I want to mention that because where Jesus says the world is headed is to a renewed earth, a new heavens and a new earth with renewed people who he raises up to inhabit that earth, and injustice will no longer be done in the new heavens and new earth, that you will never experience injustice again in the new heavens and new earth, and you will never be tempted to treat someone unjustly either. You're going to forget how to sin. That's where things are going. Now, I mention that because there's the reality of our desire to be treated justly as human beings will not fully be satisfied until one day when we see God face to face and we inhabit that new heaven and new earth. I say that to, like, lessen the dreams of utopia that we might have. But I also mention it because injustice and sin is so expansive and so large and so corrupting that there's not a human relationship, there's not a human system that doesn't have sin and corruption in it. And it's going to take God to remake the whole thing for justice to actually take place again in God's green earth. But that doesn't mean that you and I sit back passively, idly by, and wait for that day when God might create the new heavens and new earth. No, what God requires of us right now is he's creating a response in us with a relationship with him, a response in us where you and I take up the banner to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with God. Now, I don't know if you picked up in how I was reading the passage from Micah 6, in that the verse right before Micah 6, 8, where those verses have Israel sort of responding back to God. They know that they're guilty before God. And just like children who try to distract when they're guilty, they're like, oh, you know, and making God seem like this harsh tyrant. Oh, well, will you be pleased if I bring 1,000 rams? Will that please you? Would that finally, like, get you off my back, God? And God just simply says, look, I've shown you the response that I'm looking for. The response is simply this: do justice, love kindness, walk humbly with God. There's an action: do justice. There's an attitude: love kindness. There's a posture: walk humbly with God. That's the response that God was looking for from the people of Israel. And what I'd like to do this morning is I'm going to spend most of my time talking about the do justice part. So when I get a little long there, you're not like, oh man, is every point going to be like this? No, it's not. I'll go quickly through the other ones, because I do want to spend some time here, though, with this do justice one. Because one of the things that the scriptures are trying to show over and over and over again is that the relationship that God has created and established with us as human beings is one that requires us to do justice, to do justice. Do you remember the movie Princess Bride? You remember Vizzini? Vizzini kept using that word that he really didn't know what the word seemed to mean. You remember what that word was? Anybody remember what the word was? Inconceivable. Thank you. You guys are bolder than the first service. Thank you. A little bit more awake, right? Inconceivable. And finally, Inigo Montoya says to him, right, you keep using that word. I don't think you know what it means, right? It's like, finally, someone says what everybody's been thinking in the movie, right, as you're watching it. And that's important for us in this way, is that we all use the word justice, but oftentimes we don't know what it means. Or we're all using the word justice and we have competing definitions for what it means. Or we use the word justice and we have competing ideologies that support our view of that definition of the word justice. And so, God has one as well. And what we want to do is we want to learn from Scripture about what does God view justice to be? What does he view it to be? So that we can live it out. Now, I'm going to ask you a little bit to, remember like this in grade school, I don't mean to demean you, but just as a way of a funny way in, to put your thinking caps on here for a little bit. Because this is going to be a little heavy, a little heady just for a little bit, but I think it's important for us to really think through, because God shows us what justice is like. And we have to clarify it. One of the downsides about the Bible is the Bible's not a dictionary, so you can't just look up a word and go justice, and there's going to be this dictionary definition for it. A lot of times, God's talking about justice, and he's using all kinds of examples, and he's showing what that justice is. And so we have to read through the Bible and see, how is God, and infer, how is God describing what justice looks like? And there's three ways in which the Bible uses the word justice. Three ways in which the Bible uses justice. First is one that you and I are probably familiar with in living in the West and living in the United States, and that is justice requires equity and fairness. If we're going to do justice, we have to be people who live out equity and fairness. And what that means is acquitting or punishing every person on the merits of the case, regardless of race or social status. Acquitting or punishing every person on the merits of the case, regardless of race or social status. The same punishment for the same crime should be given to anyone no matter class, status, color, or any other difference. This definition of injustice is operating, say, for example, when at another time when I'm running late, I'm bringing our oldest son Levi to baseball practice, and the coach says, if you're late, you have to run laps. And he's wondering, wait a second, you're driving me there. I can't get us there any earlier. Why am I being punished for your crime? That's a great question. Take it up with the coach, right? But, you know, that's a justice question. That's a justice question. It's in his heart. It's in his heart. It's also the justice question is similar here when, I don't know how many of you have children and multiple children in the family, and they start to talk amongst themselves and say, you know, Mom and Dad were really strict on me. You're able to do something at 10 that I wasn't able to do till I was like 15. You ever had those conversations? Those are fascinating questions or conversations, right? To watch your kids have those kinds of conversations. Or maybe you've grown up in a family with multiple siblings and you're going, yeah, I'm the third. It's awesome to be the third. You know, you never raised the first one like the third one, or the third one like the first one. You just can't. You can't do it because you learn things as you go through. But those are justice questions, equity, fairness. That's what's going on in that conversation. The Bible talks that way. One of the reasons why Christians should be involved in the legal system is to try very hard to make sure that our laws and the prosecution of our laws are done with equity and fairness. That's one definition. There's also another definition, or another aspect of what justice is probably a better way to say it, another aspect of it, and this has to do with rights. And this is where I want you to start thinking about other people's rights, not your own. Definitely know your own rights, but start thinking about other people's rights, because this passage is about treating other people as they've been made to be treated, not so much concerned about you being concerned about how other people are treating you, but how you're treating other people. Justice, in this aspect, insists on the rights of others. It's giving others what they are due, because they're due certain obligations from you and me just simply by being human beings. Levi deserves me to keep my promise to him. It's justice. People around you deserve that you tell them the truth. They deserve it because it's their right. To keep the truth from them is a violation of justice. It's an injustice to lie to someone, to withhold the truth from them. We keep promises. We keep contracts with one another because they have a right to the goods and services that we have promised them. So think about what others are due. It's an obligation that you and I have. It's a claim that somebody else has on you just simply because they're a human being. So when you're interacting with other people, they have certain claims on you. The rights of other people have a burden on you to fulfill them and to treat them according to their rights. Now, I know not everybody in this room is Christian, but this is one of the reasons why I think you should be. Having human rights is based in, as a Christian, is based in a God who is just, who's made us in his image. And you and I operate in a world where everybody believes that there's such a thing as human rights. But you need to know this about our Constitution. The Constitution of America does not create rights. It can limit them, it can define them, but it doesn't create them. Those rights have to come from something else. If you look at the UN's Declaration of Human Rights, they can list out what they think human rights are that everybody is accountable to. But they not once do they say where those rights come from. And one of the reasons why I'm a Christian and why I think you should treat people justly and treat people according to their rights and to really seriously consider Christianity is because Christianity actually gives us a rational reason to believe that human beings are made with rights. It's because there's a God who actually made us, who's a just God that we're made in his image. So even if you don't believe in God, please, treat people justly. But that desire that you have actually to treat other people justly, when you know that you've done good to somebody, tease that out. Why is that there? Why is there such a thing as human rights? If we're all just molecules that are going to decompose someday anyway, why does it matter? It matters because there's a God who made us. Justice has one other aspect to it. And this justice is that you and I have a responsibility toward the weaker members of our society. A responsibility to guard against oppression, a responsibility to not oppress, responsibility not to exploit those who are easily exploited or overlooked. A couple years ago, right now we have a team of people from Faith Community over in India. And a few years ago, I was over in India, the same team, and one of the things that's a highlight of the trip for almost everybody who goes, a highlight of the trip is that you get have this opportunity to go visit with orphans and widows and lepers. And get to share food with them, get to bring them clothes, get to encourage one another as you worship Jesus together, and you get to see that, oh, wait a second, you can have all kinds of joy in life and not have a lot of material possessions. That can actually happen. You learn from them, like, oh, man, I think I need so much in life to be happy, and they have Jesus and one pair of socks and food enough for a day, and they're rejoicing. Doesn't mean it's not hard, but they've got a joy that I would love to taste. But in visiting one of these, one of the leper colonies, we were in a village, and a village in India is like 100,000 people or more. And a guy came up. He saw that we were white and American, and we were there, and he asked a question, broken English, maybe just a couple few English words. And so then a translator was helping me interact with this guy, and he asked, he goes, "What are you guys doing here? What are you all doing here?" I said, "Well, we're here to visit with widows and orphans and lepers and to meet them and care for them and hang out with them." And then he asked this question. It's a great question that gets after or describes what this other aspect of justice is. He asks this question, why do you care for them? Why do you care? Why do you care about them? He says, you're a rich American. Why do you care about them? John Nanda, our team leader, jumped in. He goes, because we serve a really generous and great God. That's why we care. But that question was a super question for defining what it's like to live out justice in a holistic sense that the Bible talks about it. We're to look around and see in our culture, in our society, in our spheres of influence, is there anybody there that if we cared for them, somebody would say, why do you care for them? That doesn't make sense. Why do you care for them? If there is anybody around us where people would be asking if we cared for them, why do you care for them? Those are the people that we're to care for. It's doing justice as a response to a relationship with God. This aspect of doing justice in response to relationship with God has caused Christians to do some crazy, risky, outlandish things in wild places. One doctor, Dr. Foster, set up a hospital in rural Angola, in Africa. He went there because that was where the child mortality rate was the highest in the world, and he wanted to save children. It was one of the wildest places because there's all kinds of corruption, there's all kinds of war, there's all kinds of famine that was going on, and it cost his family a great deal, and he was in a risky spot. One writer who wasn't a Christian, who's not a Christian as far as I'm aware of, writing for the New York Times, talks about how Foster, the son and grandson of missionaries, has survived tangles with a 6-foot cobra. With angry soldiers, he's had to make do with rudimentary supplies. Once he turned a tube for a vehicle's windshield washer fluid into a catheter to drain a patient's engorged bladder. Armed soldiers once tried to kidnap 25 of his male servants, and when Foster ordered the gunmen off the property, he said they fired AK-47s at his feet, and he stood his ground, and eventually they left without the nurses. His son contracted polio. A daughter survived cerebral malaria, The family nearly starved to death when the area was so besieged by war, and Dr. Foster insisted on sharing the family's rations with 100 famished villagers. This created tensions in the family, and the children had to work through some of the bitterness of being brought up, and especially the son who contracted polio said that he was bitter for some time, but he said, if me getting polio is what it took for my dad to help thousands of children live, that's okay. It's doing justice. Going to wild places to make sure that people live. But it's also in small ways. Also in small ways. Keeping a promise is doing justice to people. Big ways. Russ Gregg and Jeff Bird helped found Hope Academy in the Phillips neighborhood in Minneapolis. They did it because Phillips neighborhood is one of the most diverse neighborhoods in the nation. And it's also right where the line of all kinds of economic disparity is there. There's all kinds of poverty and there's all kinds of racial tension there. And they wanted to create a school that would prepare students to be excellent, to do remarkable things. And so they set up a classical Christian education in the middle of the Phillips neighborhood. I went and visited a couple years ago. They are doing amazing work. And why are they doing it? Justice. To empower kids to do remarkable things in really, really, really bad circumstances. Justice. Missional community befriends a single mom, cares for her, cares for her house. The dad or the men in the group become mentors to the son, showing him how to live godly life, caring for him, encouraging him. That's doing justice. River Falls Missional Community right now is talking with Options for Women down in River Falls to join up with them as a mission to say, hey, we want to help care for people who come through this organization and help moms who are pregnant and scared, and we want to help them choose life. Doing justice sometimes means doing unseen things and unthankful things to many people. We've got a group here at Faith Community who every first Wednesday of the month, cold, rain, snow, blazing sun, they're over at Planned Parenthood praying on the sidewalks, praying, sidewalk counseling, letting scared, terrified moms know there's another way and we'll help and we can help. There's all kinds of ways to do justice. One of the questions that you and I are called to ask in response to a relationship with God is there anyone in our sphere of influence? Is there anybody in our valley? Is there anyone in our neighborhood that if we cared for them, other people would go, why do you care for them? It doesn't make sense why you would care for them. Those are the people to help care for. It's justice. Now, response to a relationship with God isn't just about justice. It's also close. It's also about its close cousin, justice, close cousin, and that is loving kindness. That's the second command here, to love kindness. Now, that word kindness, if you look in different versions, it's going to be translated in different ways. It's a hard word to actually bring into English. I don't know if you remember this, but many years ago, Volkswagen did a marketing campaign. In their commercials, they would lead with this word, Farfignugen. Remember that word? Is that a fun word to say? Say it with me. Farfignugen. Farfignugen. It's and then the commentator would come in, it's like, it's the special oneness between car and driver. You know, it's like, what? I don't even know what that means until I started to drive, right? But they have one word, Farfignugen, that describes this whole experience that you and I can have that we in English have to describe with a sentence. They use in one word. Germans like that. They can say multiple sentences in one word. But this word here, kindness, it's translated in Hebrew. It's another fun word to say. It's chesed. Say it with me. Chesed. Chesed. Right? So it sort of clears out your throat. It's sort of fun, right? Chesed. And chesed can be translated steadfast love or kindness or faithfulness or mercy, translated in a bunch of different ways, because we're trying to bring into English this really important relationship and this character quality of God who is chesed. He's this steadfast love kind of God. One commentator, I think one of the best ways to translate this is a love that won't let you go. What characterizes God? God is characterized by a love that won't let you go. And what this command is, what this response to God's relationship with God is it's to love, to cherish, to delight in God's love for me, a love that will not let me go. He will hold me fast. A love that won't let me go, and then to take that love that God has for me, to believe it, to embrace it, to fully to take it and bring it into the center, the core of my being, and then to treat every human being that I relate to based on that love. See, we tend to separate justice and love, but the Bible holds those two things together. They're two sides of the same coin, just like faith and obedience. To treat somebody with justice is to love them. To treat someone unjustly is to hate them. I needed to ask Levi to forgive me for breaking that promise. Why? Because it was unloving. Unloving to break that promise. When we don't want to, see, this is going to be interesting, or it's going to be really troubling for our culture, because our culture is becoming more and more and more commodified in relationships. I'll treat you well as long as you treat me well. I'll support your rights as long as you support my rights. And what this is getting at is that no matter what, how somebody else treats us, we're still to take this love that God has for us. Our relationship with somebody else is not so much based in how they treat me, it's based in how God has treated me, so therefore I treat them. That's sort of the logic of this. To take the love that will never let me go and to give that to somebody else. Love, kindness, to love, kindness. And lastly, to walk humbly. Maybe you've heard this term, virtue signaling. It's a way of trying to show to others that I'm virtuous and I'm a really good person because of the products that I buy or the things that I post on social media, that kind of stuff. It's sort of an insulting term in some ways. But it's also a reality that we tend to do that. We tend to think that we're better than other people by our causes and by the things that we're cared about, by the things that we care about. We let that shape our identity rather than the gospel that shapes our identity. And what God is saying is, do justice. Love ferociously and walk humbly. Don't let it go to your head. Just simply do what I'm asking you to do. To walk humbly with God is to know that you're in relationship with Him and to personally know God, to personally know Him and to be attentive to what He requires and what He calls us to do and what He's created us to do. That's what it means to walk humbly with Him. Now, in this context, what God tells the people of Israel is that I've shown you what I require. I've shown you the response that I'm trying to create in you by my love. How did He show them? It wasn't just simply in the commands and the laws of Israel. It was in how He redeemed them from Egypt. If you look up just a few verses in this context, He says that I brought you up. I brought you up from the land of Egypt, and I redeemed you from the house of slavery. That was the beginning of a relationship that the people of Israel had with God. And God was showing them in that moment, this is how I want you to live. How I brought you out of Egypt is how I want you to live in the world in response to me. How did He bring them up out of Egypt? They were enslaved to a Pharaoh, a tyrant king, who oppressed them in so many ways, and they could not get out. And God didn't ask them to fight their way out. God just asked them to trust, and He was going to fight their way out. They didn't have to do anything except just follow what He told them to do. And God brought them out of that oppression and out of that wickedness. And He says, when I did that, I was teaching you how to live in response to me. What aggravates and what saddens God in this passage is that his people that he brought out of Egypt are living just like Pharaoh amongst themselves. Now, the logic of the Bible, the flow of the Bible, is that we're looking at, you know, how God brought the people of Israel out of slavery to Egypt. The flow of the Bible, though, is that you and I, we've experienced a redemption that's far bigger than what God did with the people of Israel and of Egypt. He's brought us out of slavery to sin. He's brought us out of slavery to sin that we've chosen for ourselves. We'd rather sin at times than obey God. We'd rather be under the lordship of sin than actually under the lordship of God. We choose that. But what God has done is he didn't just bring us out of slavery to some tyrant, some human tyrant. He's brought us out of slavery to sin and death and wickedness. And he's done it by sending his son. To send his son to live a perfect life of justice. Jesus was never unjust, never treated anyone unjustly. He was just for us. Because we've not been just all the time. We break our promises. He died a death as the most just man who ever lived. Jesus died an unjust death. He died because of a miscarriage of justice. He should not have died that way. And he should not have died on those charges. He was lynched, as it were. Why? Because you and I deserve death. He took our place. And he rose again. And in rising again and coming and sending his spirit upon you, he makes it possible, probable, a real life response to live just as he's redeemed us. To do justly, to love mercy, kindness, and to walk humbly with him until we see him face to face. That's the response. It's based in a relationship with Jesus. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your goodness, your grace, and your mercy. Help us, God, to honor you. God, if there's anyone in our circles of influence, there's anyone in our valley, there's anyone where we go, where we live, where we work, where if we cared for those people, other people would look at us and go, why do you care for them? God, turn our hearts in that direction to care for them. May you find us, God. May you find us when you return, doing justice, loving kindness, and walking humbly with you. In Jesus' name, amen.